Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Recall This Book, where I'm here, back in the studio, with my illustrious colleague and co-host, John Plotz. Hello, John.
Hey, Elizabeth.
And me, Elizabeth Ferry. And our guest today is another illustrious colleague, Janet McIntosh. Hello, Janet.
Hi.
Janet is a sociocultural and linguistic anthropologist. She's currently writing a book about language in the U.S. military. And along with these projects, with this project, she's been using tools of linguistic anthropology to examine the language of the right wing, particularly in the United States. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. So, Janet, as is our wont, maybe you could get us started and just tell us a little about your recent work and how you're looking at language use in the U.S. fits into it.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. So, yes, my history is as a sociocultural and linguistic anthropologist. I used to work in sub-Saharan Africa and switched over in recent years to looking at how language militarizes service people. And then I was sort of diverted along the way by the Trump administration and all the fascinating linguistic dynamics that were going on there. So with my colleague Norma Mendoza Denton, who's at UCLA, we co-authored a book of essays called Language in the Trump Era. And, once you start to pay attention to this stuff, it keeps grabbing at you no matter how hard you try to quit it. Right wing, I just can't quit you. So,
would you say that you were kind of attuned to these questions because of what you were? I mean, we've all been attuned to them. This is something that's very, part of the reason why your book, for instance, Language in the Trump Era, has been a lot of people have been excited about it, mm-hmm. is that it's something that people have noticed.
Yeah.
But would you say that your work...
That it's made me attuned? I think so, because I think that, the paternal disciplinarian that you get in a lot of Trump's language and a lot of the right-wing language that's mm-hmm. trying to school the left into being harder and tougher and less pathetic and sensitive and snowflakey, there really is some, as we call it, interdiscursivity with certain elements of military language.
Right.
I think I was kind of attuned to elements of that.
Yeah. And also, and this can maybe lead us to some concrete examples, the ways in which sort of the inside and outside are defined, right? Who gets to be in a group that's in on a secret or outside?
Absolutely, I mean, the Marine Corps is the ultimate in-group, for instance. And one of the things that's been so affectively powerful about alt-right language, the world of memes and so forth, and QAnon, has been that it's supremely good at making people feel empowered because they're part of an exclusive in-group.
Right.
Here's where we go away from the military, that has access to, say, in the case of QAnon, secret knowledge.
Right.
And is empowered and emboldened by this vague idea of an alternative state waiting in the wings and so forth. But it's knowing the right language that gets you access to that possibility
and that has
power.
I mean, so one of the examples we want to talk about is the Let's Go Brandon example.
Right? Absolutely.
So maybe start us out and give us a little bit of the background. I'm sure many listeners are aware of it, but
yeah, right. So I'll skip some things, but there's probably a lot of background knowledge. Okay, so that is a right wing slogan that got going in the fall of 2021. There was a Talladega race track, and a driver named Brandon Brown had won. And while he was being interviewed on live TV, there was a raucous crowd in the stands who were like ripping off their shirts and pumping their fists and chanting, "Fuck Joe Biden," like that, which was an ongoing chant at some sports games. And for whatever reason, the news broadcaster said, "Oh, listen, they're chanting, Let's Go Brandon." And it's not clear whether that was a conscious or an unconscious re-layering of the meaning.
Right.
At any rate, this was taken up with great hilarity by folks on the right.
Yes.
Let's Go Brandon became that slogan. And there's this kind of super thin veneer, this obvious pretense of not swearing, but actually underneath it all, cursing out Joe Biden and meaning to say, "Fuck Joe Biden."
Right, right.
So it's got tons of appeal. I mean, there are lots of things going on here, right? One thing I was thinking about just before coming here is that there's always this wink, like, oh, we're in cahoots with each other, with one another, as a group of anti-Biden folks, because we know what it really means. We really mean fuck Joe Biden. But that winking thing, it's like we're in cahoots. And I cast my mind back to 2008 when Sarah Palin was debating Joe Biden in the VP presidential debates. And she infamously winked multiple times at the camera. And it was her effort to do this whole, to enlist her supporters in this whole, "You and I know what's really going on."
Right,
winky,
right.
Winky.
Yeah, yeah.
It might have flown with her followers. It was mocked by the left. But but that sort of sense of, oh, there's a bit of a shared secret.
Right.
But then another layer that's going on here is that there's this whole language ideology backdrop among the right, which your listeners will know very, very well, which is a kind of a hostility to the idea that people should be careful with their language, right? Sort of the anti-PC ideology, the mockery of this idea that the details and nuances of language matter, and we have to not hurt or wound each other with language.
Right.
And I think that part of what "Let's Go Brandon" as a slogan does is it actually mocks the very idea that you'd have to mince words.
Right.
And you can see that in some of there are concrete examples of that. Like there was a T-shirt for sale that read, "Let's Go Brandon," and then, "I'd like to solve the puzzle." And underneath that, there's a graphic. It looks like it's from Wheel of Fortune, where it says "Fuck Joe Biden," but they've deleted with opaque rectangles like the U in "fuck" and the I in "Biden."
Right.
And it's like it's right there, but they're kind of pretending.
See, that's one dimension of it, because it's like a veneer, but it's a veneer that nobody is supposed to not see through.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? I mean, it's so thin that it is, I agree with you, it is a kind of mocking gesture of like,
of the idea of veneers.
Right, exactly. Like I'm going to say this, but I can't get in trouble. And, and there's a sort of media thing, like I can't get in trouble saying it on TV.
Exactly. Or on a Christmas Eve phone call with Joe Biden when one guy rang off going, "Let's go, Brandon." And then afterwards, they're like, "Oh, it's just playful fun." So you get plausible deniability.
Yeah, yeah.
And you also, if you're an evangelical who doesn't want to cuss out loud, you can put that sign in your window. And I've seen photos on the on a Facebook page of children wearing "Let's Go Brandon" sweatshirts.
Right.
There's a whole chain of stores in New England, by the way, that are now called "Let's Go Brandon."
Yes, and in your article, which we'll, if with your permission, post on our site, you visited one such store, right?
Yeah.
In a way, though, it's kind of like implausible deniability.
You know? That's a great way of putting it.
It's like, it's not like anyone really believes that they're not saying that.
That's so true. But it is fun. You know, meanwhile, it gets paired with symbolism that has been increasingly dark and violent. It's being printed on guns. It's being, you know, it was hung over an overpass, "Let's Go Brandon," next to a swastika on a big banner. It's printed on these so-called freedom frag bottle openers that are shaped like grenades. And so it's getting, and that's, we call that in semiotics, regimentation, where you keep putting one sign in proximity to other signs, and there's a kind of a rubbing off of yeah. meaning. And so it gives Let's Go Brandon a bit of a sinister, it can be fun, but it can also be sinister. And right. that pairing of levity with sinister intimations is also something that Pepe the Frog memes were great at as yeah. well. It's something yeah. the alt-right is very good at. Yeah. It's great at enlisting people affectively.
I really like your unpacking of that, Janet, that the fragging isn't just asserting the kind of, violence of the right as belonging to some sort of authoritarian impulse that is deep in our country. It's also the notion of rebellion. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that tension, the idea that it's at once, the well-disciplined right and the undisciplined right, like how does that doubleness...
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is an impossible question to answer about how the semiology of these signs works, but it's about whether it's really activating two contradictory things at once mm. and holding them together, or whether it's mm. just gesturing at the one but really adhering mm. to the other.
I don't know, but you just made me think about one thing I'm writing about when it comes to military signage during boot camp, which is that there are totally contradictory messages about the idea that this is a structure that's incredibly rule-bound, and then yeah. there are perpetual violations of those rules and
yeah.
Mm-hmm. mocking of those rules, and that...
It's how the Top Gun movies are built, right?
It's like, yeah.
We're here to be the best. We're the instrument of the U.S. government, and we're breaking every
rule. And we're breaking all the rules.
We're here to enforce the rules because right. the rules are important. Yeah. They have to be obeyed, and therefore right. we get to break them all.
Yeah. And we're going rogue. I'm reading it now because of what I'm working on as a sort of vaguely, it smells a little bit like the way that military power likes to work in the USA. That's what it's reminding yeah. me of.
It seems like a reference to the Civil War too, right? The rebel, they were the rebels,
and
the,
yeah.
that was the
right.
Right. So by kind of enrolling that stance or that position,
right. But you're also talking
you're bringing
to people,
that history with you to some extent.
Yeah, totally. But you're yeah. also talking to people who don't have a shared code book. Like it's not as mm-hmm. if like the nudge nudge wink wink mm. itself has to be. It has to carry with it its own instructions for being deciphered, because it's not as if people know it already. Mm-hmm. That's kind of why I was asking you about militarized language, because I totally take the point that anytime you enter any kind of institution, you're given sort of the jargon to activate you, you know, so
right.
that we know if something's problematic, we know what that means, you know, we're yes. professors on a campus. So yes. if you're told something's problematic, you know what to read it as. But this is different because it's meant to recruit a lot of people. Like, unlike the military, which is only, whatever it is,
right.
a million people, this is reaching 250 million
mm-hmm.
people.
Uh-huh. That's and it a doesn't good point. Have that institutional framework.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, right. I mean, recruiting tools that keep things kind of baggy like that
yeah.
can get more people.
Right.
Right.
because yeah. People can infill with the fantasy of their choosing. That's one of the geniuses of QAnon, actually,
yeah.
when it comes to the conspiratorial stuff that people are reading in.
Yeah.
They can fill in the fantasies that they're most invested in.
Maybe this is a moment to turn to QAnon, which you've also and Q drops, which you've also written about, which seem to be a different kind of secrecy because it's much deeper and it's more invested in being hard to figure out.
Right.
Maybe.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So
right. I mean, it also has a little bit of decoupling between what we call the signifier and the signified, but mm-hmm. it is deliberately much more cryptic. And that's part of the appeal.
Mm-hmm. Jenna, can you just say one more sentence on what you mean by the decoupling of the signifier and the signified?
Sure. Well, I think it's common for folks to imagine that linguistic meaning is more or less transparent, right? That we have sort yeah. of dictionaries in our head and
right.
hear a word, look up the definition.
Language sort of works on the fact that we assume that to be true.
Right. And that it's neatly intelligible.
Right.
In fact, ordinary language has all kinds of slippage and messiness between the surface form and what's actually meant. And people will give classic examples or things like if I look at the window and I say, oh, it's getting cold in here, I might really mean get up and close the window. So there's all kinds of ways mm-hmm. that on the daily we're not being 100% transparent when it comes to the relationship between the surface form of our signs, sure, our signifiers, and what we actually mean. But I do think that, especially with QAnon and then also with Let's Go Brandon, there's a more deliberate and obvious kind of sense that, okay, what you see on the surface isn't exactly what's meant. There's something more to be done.
Right.
And there are different reasons for that, like you were saying, Elizabeth. With Let's Go Brandon, it's the implausible deniability. everyone wants the meaning to be known, even though they're not saying it directly. But with QAnon, you know, that was that movement has been very empowering in a different way because there's a real decoupling between the sign forms themselves in the Q drops that Q started to put on 4chan and 4kun and 8kun back in 2017. There's a real discrepancy between those signs and any kind of clear meaning.
Right.
And in fact, you have to have an arsenal. Well, first of all, it's never entirely clear what Q wanted to mean, but they're leaving all these little clues, cryptic, aphorisms, numbers, letters, acronyms, and so forth, and saying things like everything is connected, and look forward to look backward. These little cues about how you're meant to interpret them to dig for something deeper.
So Janet, can I ask a sort of historical linguistic question? Isn't that always been true of prophecy, like going back to Nostradamus or something?
Yeah. Actually, so in an article I wrote about it, I say it's a lot like divination.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, my earlier work in Kenya, one thing I looked at was how diviners would use modes of language that were totally unintelligible to ordinary people, and you had to have special access to, like, the supernatural truths in order to decode them.
Like the Delphic Oracle.
Like glossolalia, speaking in tongues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the tongues of men and angels are usually indecipherable to the ordinary human ear, but sometimes there are folks who claim to be able to interpret the tongues as they come because they have a more direct channel to the divine.
Right.
So it actually, that's part of how QAnon, I think, has gotten its power, is through this sort of vaguely divinatory language. A lot of what it says is quite prophetic. Right?
Yeah.
Nothing can stop what's coming. The storm is coming.
Mm-hmm.
Or, weirdly, you're going to love how this movie ends.
So in some sense, it's the opposite of the implausible deniability part, the Let's Go Brandon.
Really good
point.
Which
is just one-to-one correspondence or something.
Yeah.
Whereas this is meant to be.
Yeah, and it seems like it produces, and this is where there's kind of a creepy resemblance to, like, literary critique and stuff, right? It produces a community of people who are debating different interpretations, right? And sort
That's
of,
right.
And that, like, has its own kind of community
and you feel
community
and you feel powerful as the person who can see beneath the surface.
Strong readers and weak readers, close readers.
Yes, find the hegemony.
It's originalists, probably, foundationalists.
Yeah, indeed. Well, and with QAnon, of course, a lot of the people who became adherents, you know, Anons, followers, code crackers, people who would bake the so-called breadcrumbs, or people who feel alienated from the so-called elite experts. So the experts in the university are exactly who they do not want to be looking to for the real truth.
Right.
They have direct access to it. And that's tremendously empowering for them. That was was and still is. And then that cryptic language, you know, having secrets is power. You know, George Simmel wrote about this, right?
Yes.
Secrecy equals power, whether that's about holding a secret or cracking a secret. All of those are empowering.
Right.
So it was very, very empowering. And it felt state-like. I think it has felt like there's this alt state waiting in the wings.
Yes, yes. That has this kind of looking glass quality to relationship to what are perceived as the institutions of power now.
Look, by looking glass quality, you mean?
Well, I don't know. Maybe this is pushing it, but is there? Do you feel like there's any kind of degree of implicit, like, okay, now we're going to use these tools of, you know, we're going to be the ones who know the inner knowledge and can lord it over the rest of you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I mean, like that it's sort of like a looking glass university discourse or something like that, or a looking glass elite discourse. You disagree?
No, I agree. I was just thinking of this Adorno essay from the 50s, The Stars Down to Earth, about why people like astrology. Mm-hmm. And that astrology, specifically on that power question, it's actually not a political conspiratorial account. It's just an account of, like, wanting to know that there's some kind of esoteric order that is available to common people through newspaper astrological columns, which align you with the stars, which are so much more important than any earthly configuration. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's transcendently important.
Transcendently, yeah.
Yeah, and that require esoteric tools and...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and meanwhile, everything that comes out of the mouth of, Democrats and university professors and scientists and so forth should be subject to skepticism. It's a whole epistemological orientation where one must read beneath the surface,
right,
whether it's for the dastardly realities of the left's cabal of, pedophilic conspiracies, or whether it's because Trump is trying to tell you something with the way he moved his hand in that meeting.
Right.
So, Jen, are you making a strong claim for the political affinity to the right? Like, is there an elective disposition towards right-wing politics with this? Or is it just happened to be the case that QAnon itself is, which is manifestly a right-wing conspiracy thing? But, examples.
It's not that strong a claim. Yeah. I just think it's a really handy way of making people feel empowered and congealing them affectively around a community. But it's also effective, as we've been saying in the academy, too, feel like you can read beneath the surface. Yeah. In fact, Ricoeur's idea of the hermeneutics of suspicion.
Totally.
Is that, this notion that a la Marx, a la Freud, so much of what we see on the surface of society, we should be reading more deeply into for these patterns of these forces of capital and this subconscious and so forth.
And then, so zooming back out just for a little bit, all of these kind of secrecy and, delicate operations of veiling and unveiling exist also within a politics of direct speech. And, we tell it like it is.
Exactly.
And what you've described as semiotic callousing, which I'd like you to unpack for our listeners.
Yes, that is, and it is really different, and in some ways, as you say, contradictory. To the delicacy with which, like QAnon, will construct a drop, and the interpreters will interpret it. So this idea of semiotic callousing came up for me when I was looking at the way language is used during basic training in Parris Island, South Carolina, which is one of two Marine Corps recruit training depots in the States. And
it's in a Billy Joel song.
Is it?
No.
It is.
I did not know that.
His sort of metonym for Vietnam is that they come from Parris Island.
But, oh, well. Yeah.
Mm. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah. So, and of course, everyone who's seen, Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket is familiar with some of what goes on in Parris Island. It's true. There's a lot of yelling. And it is true that recruits are still insulted, although the rules of, the recruit training order says you're not meant to demean and insult and disrespect and so forth. And, of course, the drill instructors do that all the time.
Yes.
They're a little – they don't venture as often into things like racial slurs, but there's still all the gendered trouble.
Right.
I'm not sure how blue to get on this show, but, pansies and homophobic stuff, little girls, cupcakes and so forth. So and, okay, so what's going on there? I mean, there's a lot. It's a rite of passage. People are being ground down, a la Victor Turner. But it's also, I think there's a teaching tool within the very use of insults that all your old sensitivities need to be dulled, whether that has to do with your personal vulnerability or your empathic mercy for, say, the enemy. Because, it's in some very, very loose fashion, the drill instructor is to the recruit as the Marine is to the enemy.
Wow.
Because the Marine will turn around and then use dehumanizing slurs and insults and so forth against the people that they're supposed to kill.
But not pedagogically.
Not pedagogically anymore. No.
Right.
So this, the first kind of the wave of semiotic callousing really, really starts during basic training. And it is indeed pedagogic.
Mm-hmm.
So,
it's kind of a live fire drill. Like, you're meant to be able to put up with all these things, since there are things you might be able to, you might have to endure out in the world. And then civilians are different because they can't endure these things because they haven't been toughened.
Yeah, especially left-wing civilians. But, and especially women, and especially gay people and so forth. Gay men. But, yes, absolutely. And when you say it's like a live fire drill, I'm really riveted by the way that this mode of using language is talked about by Marines and veterans and drill instructors in this kind of quasi-physical way. Like, you're meant to thicken your, you're meant to develop a thick skin. You're meant to let it roll off you. It's it's like as if the you're getting little verbal semiotic bullets. And you're meant to harden yourself. And that's supposed to translate into
or like napalm or something.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I'm just, I guess I'm asking about this notion of abusive language, or the language that is like, you know, sort of declaring one's allegiance to, you know, whatever, a sort of Trump speech, I guess. How much you understand that as being abuse in order to put people in their place versus how much you're connecting it to the sort the drill sergeant model, which is more like toughening you up
so you can be one
of us.
Right. I know. Right.
Pedagogic as opposed to abusive.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. I don't know. This is good
for conversation.
But I
mean, the abusive is also pedagogic to some other potential listener, right? I mean, when they're calling,
when you're yelling at someone
and saying you're a liberal crybaby, you're also signaling to the other people who you believe will agree with you, or you hope will agree with you.
That's
right?
A great point. And maybe you're getting, you know, no one wants to be called a wuss or a crybaby or infantilized or whatever, or sometimes feminized. So maybe it gets swing people over to this empowering side of of Trumpy discourse.
It's actually, I mean, it's. There is this funny way in which social media enables that kind of communication, because often social media is, or, you know, let's say a tweet, you know, has a presumed or performed direct object of you. I'm speaking to you, Queen Elizabeth, or whatever. but in fact, the tweet is speaking to other people.
That's right.
Who agree.
The intended audience is someone other than the supposed target.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So. All right. Yeah. Well, this may be our moment to begin turning towards home. And as our listeners will know, we generally have a section called recallable books, which don't necessarily have to be literal books, that, you know, this conversation may have provoked in our minds and maybe in your minds, so that, you know, if you want to go down any of these rabbit holes, here are some ideas. So perhaps I'll begin with, and John will laugh at me. But,
I will not.
Although
I'll
laugh
gently with you.
There have been very few times that I have suggested a Trollope novel in this podcast as my recallable book, but this is going to be one of them. It's not actually a terrifically good novel. It's called Marion Fay, one of the later Trollope.
I've never read it.
But it's, I'm not sure. Well, you know, go for it. But but there's a part of it which one of the main characters, Marion Fay, the title character, is a Quaker who becomes a lord, falls in love with her. And there's a passage in which, and it has a very interesting father-daughter relationship. They're often really kind of good father-daughter relationships in Trollope novels. And he speaks in what's called Quaker plain speech, which has a number of different features, but maybe the most famous and kind of prominent feature is referring to people as thee and thou, or thou and thee. The passage in the novel says that, you know, her father kind of absolved her of doing this so that she would use you, which is, you know, was at the time the, you know, as in French or Spanish, was a plural form of the second person that was used as a form of respect in contrast to the singular form, which is thou and thee, which was used for children or persons of lower stature, right? So, and Trollope says, and thus she was absolved from the slight tinge of hypocrisy of Quaker speech. And it really reminded me of this sort of, you know, complicated, somewhat unpredictable, but also highly wrought use of language as kind of enrolling different kinds of politics, because, of course, Quaker plain speech was intended as a leveling, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody should be getting, you know, a special pronoun because we're all, you know, sinners and we're all equal in our relationship to God.
Like in Spain in the Civil War, the royalists use you.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Two, right.
And it reminded me of an article by Michael Silverstein about that shift where this sort of interesting thing happened because the Quakers started, you know, very pointedly using thou and thee, kind of irking other people who rebelled against this and saw it as a kind of slightly, you know, rogue or rebellious and maybe even, you know, hypocritical, as Trollope seems to suggest. And so they kind of double down on you. And the argument is that that's sort of the shifting moment when, in fact, everybody started. It did, in fact, lose its kind of sense of hierarchy, right?
Right.
But instead of, as the Quakers had hoped, calling everyone thee and thou, we call everyone you. So there's an article by Silverstein, which we'll put on the site.
Yeah, I want to read that article. I'm not sure I want to read that novel, but I definitely want to read that article.
Yes, I might even put the passage, since it is in the public domain. John, do you have a...
I do. It's very short, and I'm imagining some listeners may be thinking of it already, which is the Richard Hofstadter article from 1964, The Paranoid Style in American Politics, and it was a pleasure to go back and reread it. American politics has often been an arena for angry minds, and he goes on to say, I call this way of thinking in American politics the paranoid style simply because no other word adequately evokes the sense of heated exaggeration, suspiciousness, and conspiratorial fantasy. And, you know, the reason I was asking your question about the innate right-wingness, Janet, was like to think about, you know, people like Hofstadter make the argument that there's something distinctive about American, you know, radically democratic politics from the 19th century that sparked this. I mean, going back to the, you know, to the populists who always had sort of left and right-wing dimensions, but were often conspiracy thinkers. They often were afraid of the bankers. They were afraid of the international Jewish conspiracy. And yet they were also, you know, very left-wing in some of their politics. So just to think about what that, you know, the difference between openness, kind of in a way like a search for an open democratic politics that precisely depends on conspiracies about there being locked rooms elsewhere that openness can't reach. And so that Hofstadter article is 60 years old now, 70, but it seems...
That's 60. Great. I would love to look at that.
Yeah. Janet.
Yeah, I wanted to share a book by a fellow anthropologist named Susan Lepp-Selter. She published a book in 2016 titled The Resonance of Unseen Things, Poetics, Power, Captivity, and UFOs in the American Uncanny. So she did incredible fieldwork in Nevada among UFO believers. This is a really poetic, sympathetic, beautifully written book. She is interested in... I mean, this has to do with reading the signs in the world and interpreting what forces lie beneath them. And the UFO believers do have something in common with QAnon followers in the sense that they're constantly connecting the dots, like, you know, constellations in the night sky. They'll find a a figure there. There's a word for that called apophenia, which is where you draw connection. You find patterns in random signs. And one of the things that Lubseltzer argues is that all this perception of the uncanny signs of aliens among this community in Nevada, aliens who capture and trap people, it's kind of a big metaphor for the malaise and hopelessness, the despondency of downward economic mobility. So here we have, it's a twofer, because we have the UFO believers reading into the signs beneath them and finding aliens, right? And then we have Lubseltzer reading what the UFO believers are saying about UFOs
It's apophenia all the way down.
I'm reading like a good ethnographer, a wonderful ethnographer, reading beneath them to the deeper meaning. And in this case, we can actually go back to Marx, right? It has to do with despondency about capitalism, late capitalism.
Right. Yeah.
But it's a wonderful, wonderful read. I highly recommend it.
You remember that Saturday Night Live set of sketches about alien abduction?
Are we reenacting? Yes. I want to be.
Yeah, but, All right.
For the moment, nothing remains except to thank Janet so much for a great conversation and for
pleasure
for coming
to
talk with us.
What a fantastic thing you have going now. And what number is this again?
It's going to be in the high 90s. Yes. So listeners, you know, interpret this as you will. We're closing in on our 100th episode. And as always, we really thank you for listening and hope to hear back from you as well. Thanks a lot.
Recall This Book was founded by John Plotz and me, Elizabeth Ferry. It is sponsored by Brandeis University and the Mandel Humanities Center. Sound editing is by Naomi Cohen. Website design and social media by Miranda Peary of the English Department. We are eager to hear your comments, criticisms, and thoughts. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. From all of us here at RTV, thanks for listening.